Hello, our second post-US election edition of the Bruin podcast sees me, Guy Foster, talking to Andy Blocker, head of US government affairs at Invesco. And we're going to be asking Andy whether the world of politics is saying goodbye to Trump or Trumpism. But bear in mind that we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember that when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. Now, with that said, and to find out what the political future of America holds, let's get on and talk to Andy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Bruin podcast with me, Guy Foster. I'm the head of research at Bruin Dolphin, and I am joined by Andy Blocker, who's the head of US government affairs at Invesco. So, Andy, welcome to the podcast. Well, welcome back to the podcast. Obviously, you have joined us before, but this is a particularly interesting time for you to join us. Because we are still really just digesting what appear to be the results of the latest US presidential and congressional elections. And I suppose maybe if we could just have a bit of a timestamp. So right at the moment, the result is not known, but we have a strong sense of what the result is going to be. So, you know, perhaps you could just give us your take on what that is.
So, yes, Guy, great to be back with you. Your analysis is right. So right now, while Donald Trump still holds the lead in Pennsylvania, it is very clear that by today, tomorrow, Joe Biden will take over with those votes.
Probably by the time people get to listen to this, that's probably already going to have happened. But yeah, carry on. Yeah,
exactly. And once he takes the lead, he's not relinquishing the lead. All the ballots coming in are mail-in ballots. As we've discovered, mail-in ballots favor Joe Biden. And so I think the networks will call Pennsylvania for Joe Biden at that point, and he will cross 270 with most networks. Now, we just had Georgia, where Joe Biden also went to lead in Georgia as well, and he's going to expand that lead as more votes come in. But he'll probably only have a couple thousand vote lead at the end of that. And then they have to do provisional ballots. They have to do remaining military ballots. But at the end, I think he's going to, and in the count, I think he's going to be ahead in Georgia as well. It's he's going to win Nevada. All those votes coming in from Nevada are in Biden districts. And then Arizona, he probably will hold on there. That's a little tighter. That's going to be very close. But at the end of the day, he's got some wiggle room. He's got multiple paths to the presidency for the Electoral College. And right now, it's just all about how the Trump team tries to challenge those results.
Yeah, so there is just loads that's, I mean, this was obviously something that there was a threat that the president or the former president or it was eliciting months ahead of the election. So, I mean, what are the chances of success? What are the chances that that some of these legal challenges might actually overturn what appears to be the result at the moment?
Great question. That's the question of the hour. And I think the simple answer is not much. I don't want to give a percentage on it because there's always a chance. And so I think we accredit to you, someone, either Churchill or someone over there, saying that Americans always find a way to do the right thing, but only after exhausting every other avenue. Yes. Or something like that. So we'll figure out a way to make it messy. Democracy is messy. So right now, Donald Trump is in the process of throwing everything up against the wall to see what sticks. And so far, case by case is being thrown out by judges as frivolous or not really meaningful. The only case we've been looking at is a case that started before the election with respect to the Pennsylvania ballots that did not arrive on election day at 8 p.m., but were allowed to arrive all the way up until Friday at 5 if they were postmarked on election day. And so our thinking of that, even with that, we don't really think the Supreme Court is just going to take up a case, one, if it's not determinative. So if it's Biden has won not needing Pennsylvania, if he wins Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, and he doesn't need it, they're not going to take time to take up a case that doesn't determine who the president is. So that's the first hurdle. The second hurdle, if it does come down to Pennsylvania, it's going to be, are those votes that arrive after 8 p.m. on Tuesday determinative of who wins the state? So if they don't make the difference, then I don't see a reason for the Supreme Court to get involved. The thing you should know is that all the votes being counted right now don't include those votes. Because of this court case, the Secretary of State of Pennsylvania set aside those votes and is only going to count them once all the votes that arrive by 8 p.m. have been put in, and is going to count them along with the provisional ballots and other ballots that they count later.
Okay, so the upshot of that is that Biden might win Pennsylvania without needing those votes, and he might win the election without needing Pennsylvania. And the other cases, you don't attach a huge probability of success to.
Well, when you have a case, that's right. When you have a case, you need to have some evidence of fraud, malfeasance, wrongdoing, harm to your campaign. And until you do that, the courts aren't going to really look at it. So right now, it's just talk. Now, if they come up with some things where it looks like there's systemic fraud and they have hard evidence, not only will a court take it up, but in a public relations situation, it will go from this, oh, Donald Trump's just trying to spin things up, to, oh, we have something legitimate, and some of his supporters will get really upset, and that could cause a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
As it should. If there's something legitimate, it should cause trouble.
Well, I suppose it could cause a lot of trouble even if it's illegitimate as well, on that sort of public stirring up.
Unfortunately, on that note, it already has, and it will continue. There's a number of people who are diehard Trump fans. They listen to everything he says, whether it's true or not. Sometimes it's true. Let's not say it's not always true. But yeah, that's going to be there for some time. And I mean, that really goes to the fact that I think that Trumpism is not going away, even if Trump does.
Right. Well, I wanted to really ask you about that. I guess that's one of the things that that I think people are watching is, what is the reaction of other members of the party to the noises that the president's making, to the legal challenges? Is he being supported by members of his party, or is he being effectively disowned?
Right now, it's a split decision. There are some who are tepidly staying with him, because remember, his voters, the people who love Donald Trump, are the voters they need. So they're not going to just jump on him right now while he still technically has a chance. But there are some who are at least saying, they're not going at Donald Trump, but they're at least saying, look, let the votes be counted. They're tangentially saying, hey, I don't agree with your messaging here. But I don't think they're doing a frontal assault on him.
And then is there going to have to be some kind of moment of reckoning then, some kind of post-mortem amongst the Republican Party, and to determine whether they're going to continue with a sort of Trumpist tack or move back towards the party that Republicans have historically been?
I actually do not think so. I don't think, remember in 2012 and Romney lost to Obama?
Yeah.
They did this, I think Reince Priebus was the chairman of the Republican National Committee. They did this, you know, hard look at the party and said, they put together this report and said, we need to be better in how we talk to minorities, Hispanics, African-Americans, and women, and they didn't really follow any of that. They went to Donald Trump. Okay, so now that they have Donald Trump, he's a hero. He's a co-leader.
Sorry, the party decided it was going to do that, but effectively the Republican voters decided that they were going to go for Donald Trump instead.
Exactly. And in politics, politicians go where the voters are. And right now, the voters, remember now, we've talked about this a little bit before, Donald Trump is not the one causing the angst. He's channeling the angst that already exists. I mean, I've talked about this before. Like, normally we hire someone to be president who can help make Washington work. But American people, a lot of them have no longer think that Washington works for them, so they don't want you to make Washington work. They want you to blow it up. And he's actually delivered on that. He has actually gone after every institution in Washington, every norm, and they love it. So if you're a Trump voter, you're a Trump supporter, you're loving it. And if you're a Republican senator, when you go home and I talk to these guys, they say, hey, I said, how'd it go at home? And they go, well, the first question I got when I landed on the plane was, are you with our guy, Donald Trump? Are you with our president? And the correct answer is not, I'm with him when I agree with him, and I disagree with him when I don't. No, I'm with him. That's the right answer. And so even with him not there, people are, if they want them to vote for, if the Republicans who remain want that vote, they're not going to be able to go after Donald Trump. They're going to have to keep some of that same Trumpism in their messaging, or they're going to lose them. They're going to be disaffected, and they're not going to vote for them or not vote at all.
So it's not his charisma, his turn of phrase, his sort of dominance of the media, which always seems sort of very haphazard, but somehow it seems to work so well. You think it's like that underlying idea, and that potentially there's any number of people who could rise to be the figurehead still of that movement.
You bring up a great point. I think you're right, but I think it's both. It is, I mean, he is a unique character. So he's able to get away with a lot more in the way he speaks and the way he talks, because he's a reality TV star. So he's cut a lot of slack when he says things that are extremely offensive, right? The things that you only say in your home or at a bar when you've had a few too much to drink. Because he's a reality TV star. But a normal politician, while they will try to channel that angst and some of the issues and the emotion, they're not going to be able to talk the way he talks. I mean, you've seen it where other Republicans try to get out there and they say crazy stuff. They're apologizing within a week,
yeah,
or, you know, whatever, a couple of days, because they're like, oh, oops, I'm not Donald Trump. So the rhetoric will have to be toned down. It'll go back to the way it was before. You say those unspoken things. You don't say the unspoken things, but you say things that point to those unspoken things. And so it'll be a little more undercover, but they're going to still try to channel all of the anxiety and the anger and the angst that's out there on all these different issues.
Okay, well, look, I mean, that's Donald Trump. And it's easy, obviously, to spend a lot of time talking about him and the absence of him and stuff like that. But let's just talk about the other part of this race, or the other meaningful part of this race, which is the race for the Senate. So, I mean, that's looked bleaker for the Democrats really since very soon after voting closed. But just give us an update on where we are with that race, because it's not completely dead, right?
That's right. So at the beginning of the night, they had 47 Senate seats. They need to get to 50 with Biden as president. And they gained net one. They lost Alabama, which we expected. They gained Colorado and Arizona. So they're net one. So they're 48. We still haven't called the race in North Carolina. They're taking their time voting and tallying their votes until next week. So that's kind of a 25% chance they're able to make up how far their candidate Cunningham is behind. But let's say, for instance, that they don't get North Carolina. They're going to need two more seats. And the interesting thing right now is that in Georgia, there are going to be two runoffs. Neither of the candidates on both elections for Senate there reached 50%. So that means they're going to be in a runoff in January. And there's going to be a lot of money and a lot of attention put in those two, because if the Democrats win both of them, they will get control of the Senate. Now, if they win North Carolina, they'll only need one of those seats. But if they don't get North Carolina, they're going to need both.
Because they only need to, assuming that Joe Biden is president, then they only need to get to 50 seats in the Senate to effectively control it, right?
Yes, because the vice president will be the tie-breaking vote in the Senate.
Now, am I right that you wouldn't expect Democrats to perform very well in a runoff in Georgia? Is that's my understanding. Is that correct?
That's typically true, because a runoff has lower turnout. Low propensity voters don't go out as much. Only the truly committed will go out. So that's normally true. In this case, there is actually, in one of the races, there's a prominent African-American candidate on the Democratic side who will actually motivate African-Americans to get out to vote. So that's a plus, and that'll help both races. And the other thing is that you're not going to have the Trump voters. There's a thing called Trump voters. Like, they only go out when Donald Trump is on the ticket. And so someone like Perdue, Senator Perdue, he was able to do that tightrope of appealing to the mainstream Republican and the Trump voter, and that's why he almost got 50%. I think he's at 49.8, so he just missed it. So he's going to have to go in this runoff with pretty much a strong African-American vote coming at him and not the backing of the Trump voter. So it'll be closer. If I were betting, I still say they hold them, but it would be too close.
Explain to us the relevance of the Senate, because they have to approve Biden's choices for the cabinet. Is that right?
That's correct. So we're not a parliamentary system, mostly because of the Brits. We're trying to just not do things the way you did them. Actually, no, we were doing it in reaction to, and because we basically were like, no, we want to divide up power. We want, checks and balances so that there's a House that's voted separately, there's a Senate voted separately, and the President's separate. And we set up the system where the Senate, while the President can appoint a nominee for a position, the Senate has to approve it. And so, yes, with a majority of Republicans in the Senate, there's going to be a lot more scrutiny on the cabinet and all the different positions, including judges, that that President Biden would put forth.
So with the tail end of Obama's presidency, there were some judge appointments that were left open, and obviously that created a huge opportunity for Donald Trump. I mean, what happens then with the cabinet? Can they just keep rejecting his choices, or at some stage are they just forced to accept someone or something?
Well, they're never forced to, but I think politically speaking, if they block every cabinet, the norm in Washington is you let opposing party's president get his cabinet. So it's like, okay, you want to go a certain direction, here's your cabinet. Now on judges, especially Supreme Court judges, it might be a different story, like it was at the end of the Obama presidency. But when it comes to the cabinet, unless they're like wild-eyed crazy people that they're totally fearful of, I think they're going to let them through. And I don't think Biden's going to appoint anyone who's out of the mainstream anyway.
How much does it make a difference for the way in which Biden governs that his victory has been so much narrower than had been anticipated a few days ago?
So I'm going to challenge that for a second.
Okay.
I'll challenge it from this perspective, that it was narrower only vis-a-vis the news media hype and the polling. Okay. And what I mean by that is that, look, my bid-ask spread on this election was anywhere from a Biden blowout to a now Trump victory. And that was it. And I never got to the blowout stage because, I've learned not to trust polls entirely. But I do think that when we come down to it, this could be a pretty substantial win for Joe Biden. Not only will he exceed what Hillary Clinton did in the popular vote, where I think she did around 3 million net over Trump, I think he could get 4 to 5 million over, which is a pretty significant thing. And if he's able to win Pennsylvania, hold on to his lead in Georgia, hold on to Arizona and Nevada, he's up to 306 electoral votes. So I hear what you're saying. It's more about beating expectations is what you're talking about. But when you look at it, it's a pretty big win for Biden. But that's the problem. It's only a big win for Biden. It didn't translate to the United States Senate and the House. The House, where the Democrats will actually lose seats. They'll maintain the majority, but they'll lose seats. And the Senate, where they had hopes of getting to a majority without relying on the Georgia runoffs.
Is it too soon to understand why that would have happened? Why the generic ballot has sort of steered everyone to think that there was going to be much stronger general Democratic performance in the House and the Senate than actually transpired?
So the general ballot, okay, that's fine. That was off. That's always off. Because it's skewed by states like California and New York, and they haven't figured out how to figure that out. But the things that people were paying attention to were the polls in the states. And this year they thought they fixed it. They're paying more close attention to non-college educated white voters. They had national polling outlets come and do state polling for the first time. And they thought, okay, we've got this new methodology. We've got these professionals who do national polling coming into the states. And they were way off. And I think what it comes down to is that two things, and they're pretty much the same things from the last time, but they're just a different version. So last time it was that they undersubscribed certain demographics, right? And all the late breaking votes went to Trump because it usually goes to the outsider.
Yeah.
Well, there were here this time, they accounted for them more, but they didn't account for them enough. there was more to come. And then second, even though it was a smaller portion of late breaking votes, a lot of them went to Trump again, because even though he's the incumbent president, he's been president 4 years, he's still the outsider. And so, so I think a combination of those things. I also think late breaking, there were some issues that came out, and some like socialism was a big issue. So I think Biden got tagged with a lot of the rhetoric in the Democratic Party, and that hurt him in Florida with the Cuban American population, who they obviously hate socialism. So that was a big boon. He didn't get the Latino vote at the size he would normally get. And I also think there's just another, I could go on, but there's a number of other issues like that that came in at the end that I think started to sway people.
Okay, well, that's useful, actually. I wanted to ask you really what happened in Florida. What is the issue with Latino votes and why they would favor President Trump? Because I think from where we sit, that always seems quite a surprising allegiance. But I think your previous answer has really addressed that pretty well. So look, that's been a really useful conversation, but I think we'd better draw it to a close. So let me just finish off by asking you then, is this a result that Democrats should be pleased about then? Or given where expectations were before, is it something they should be disappointed about?
I think long term, Democrats should be pleased about this, because they're being given a message by the voters and they have a chance to listen before 2022. Don't talk about socialism. Don't talk about all these other side issues. Make sure you focus on our economic well-being. That's what's most important. We're most important, not your ideology. And pay attention to those people in your swing districts and swing states. And don't veer too far to the left. And I think the fact that President, soon-to-be President Biden, is actually very centrist-minded, even though he's liberal in some policies, he's going to work. He's going to be the best standard bearer for the Democratic Party over the next couple of years. So from that perspective, I think it's good. Short term, they're not getting everything they want. But, you know, sometimes when you don't get everything you want, it's actually good for you.
Okay. So a message we probably all give to our children, I suppose. All right. That Andy, that's really useful. Thanks very much for giving us your fascinating insight onto this complex and evolving situation. And thanks also to all of our listeners. We really appreciate you taking the time to listen in. Hopefully you found it useful, and hopefully as well you will join us again for a future edition of the Bruin Podcast.